This week we close Parshas Chumash Shemos with Parshas Pekudei. And although on the face of it the Parsha is quite technical in nature, it's a reckoning of the various parts of the Mishkan, but needless to say there is yet quite a bit that the Meforshim discuss, a good amount of Parshanut. And in fact, The questions of the commentators begin really with the opening words. Eile Pekudei HaMishkan, Pekudei HaMishkan, Mishkan HaEdus, which is in Perek Lamed Ches, Posuk Kaf Aleph. And the question, in fact, is most basic. What is the translation of the word Pekudei? What is the meaning of the introductory phrase, Eile Pekudei HaMishkan? And once we understand what this phrase is introducing, we then ask, what's the balance of the Pasuk? What's the import, the message of the rest of the Pasuk? Mishkan HaEdus, which is the Mishkan and Testimony, Asher Hukad Al Pi Moshe, organized through Moshe, Avodas HaLevim Biyad Isamar Ben Aaron HaKohen. The Avoda was done or overseen through the Levim, who Itamar, and Betzalel Ben Uri Ben Hur Lamate Yehuda. These are all details, in a sense, that we know. And if we didn't know them, how do they relate to the opening words, Pekudei HaMishkan? And as we will see, there is a difference of opinion here, difference of interpretation between Rashi on the one hand and the Sephorno. Rashi explains, and Unkelus would seem to corroborate, Rashi's words, "Beparsha zu nimnu kol mishkalei nidvas hamishkan." Beparsha, all of the amounts of contributions for the Mishkan, kesev, Zav, Nechoshes, all those metals, V'nimnu kol keilav l'chol avodos. So everything is reckoned out. Pekudei seems to be a reckoning, a counting in that way. There are a number of words in the Torah for counting. There can be minyan, and there can be misbar, and there can be mifkad. And Unkelus translates ilen minyane mashkana. From the word minyan, mifkad is account, Pekudei is accounting amounts. And indeed, we find in a couple of psukim time that some of the amounts are reckoned out. So that's Rashi. For Rashi, Pekudei is amounts, counting, accounting in that way. The Sephorno has a different approach to the word Pekudei, which really opens up the whole of the beginning of the Parsha. Because according to the Sephorno, the word Pekudei relates to the idea of not so much accounting in terms of numbers, but taking account of something, taking note of something, to be significant. It's about the status of these items. Pekudei HaMishkan is the accounting of the Mishkan in the sense of an evaluation of the status of the parts of the Mishkan. The Sephorno connects or attaches, associates the word Pekudei with the pasuk in Parshas Bamidbar, which says in Perek Dalet, "Uvishemos tifkedu eskim mishmeres saam." Shall account through name all of the kim that are under the jurisdiction of the various houses of Levi. And what that means, uvishemos Tifkadu, take account through names. This brings us to the Sephorno's very special relationship with the idea of a name. For us, or perhaps the common notion, is a name is a way of identifying something. But for the Sephorno, for something to have a name means it has distinction, it has a certain mala. And this is evident in the writings of the Sephorno from the very beginning of Chumash Shemos, which begins with the word Shemos. These are the names. Ve'ele Shemos b'nei Yisrael. It doesn't say Ve'ele b'nei Yisrael. These are the sons of Yisrael and then name them, but rather Elah Shemos, it introduces these are their names. And we're mindful, moreover, of the fact that we already know the names of Yaakov. They were named at the end of Chumash Bereishis and Parshas Vayigash when they came down. But the Chumash opens it by reiterating the names of Bnei Yisrael. And in the words of the Sforno, Ve'ele Shemos Bnei Yisrael, Re'uyim Lizacher Batorah Bishmam. They are deserving of being mentioned in the Torah by their name. That is the most impactful way to express the distinction of this first generation that came down to Mitzrayim. And moreover, in a sense, this is also the Torah's way of tracking what's really the Yeridas Hadoras, the degeneration, as their children and their grandchildren did not retain the distinction of the first generation. And according to some, that was a catalyst for much of the trouble that came about. It was commensurate with that lowering of their madrega. And therefore, when the Pasuk says, Vayomas Yosef, V'chol Echav, V'chol Ador Hahu, meaning that type of person died out. That generation that was so distinctive and so exalted, their children and grandchildren did not maintain those standards, and that is the conceptual introduction to the Chumash of Shemos. And similarly here. And the Sforno, moreover, explains, and as we will see, he will compare and contrast these elements of the Mishkan with later Mikdashim, the first Beis HaMikdash, the second Beis HaMikdash, because you will find, says the Sforno, that no harm ever befell any element or any item of the Mishkan. It went its course, and then it was dismantled, but it was never fell into enemies' hands, never fell into disrepair. For as long as it ran its course, it was in good repair. And this is in contrast to later Batei Mikdash, as we know, and as the Sforno will detail. Because according to the Sforno, the ensuing phrases in the Pasuk are now corroborating this idea. For the Pasuk continues, Fekudei HaMishkan is the status of the Mishkan. Mishkan HaEdus. That's a statement about the Mishkan. It's Mishkan HaEdus. And what does that tell us? It says Forno, that it housed the Luchos. That's important. Number two, Asher Pukad Al Pi Moshe. The general overseer was Moshe, and it doesn't get better than Moshe. That made a difference to the Mishkan. Moreover, who else was involved? Avodas HaLevim, the Levim, Biyad Isamar Ben Aaron HaKohen. These are men of great distinction. And those that involved in the practical work were none other than Betzalel, Ben Uri, Ben Hur, Lemate Yehuda. These are very great people. Which means, according to the Sforno's understanding, the Pasuk isn't just repeating things that we know about the Mishkan. And we know who made the Mishkan, and we know that Moshe was there. But all of this is explaining to us and elaborating upon the theme of Pekudei HaMishkan. And thus, says Forno, compare this with, for example, the first Beis HaMikdash. Now, on the one hand, it's the Beis HaMikdash. It has certain characteristics in common with the Mishkan, because the Mishkan, shall we say, is four for four. All of those involved were men of distinction. Well, when it comes to the Beis HaMikdash, the initiator is Shlomo HaMelech. That's good. Shlomo HaMelech. And it also housed the Aron, so it has that Eidos aspect. So far, these first two elements are analogous to the original Mishkan. But there, the comparison and the equation ends. Because when we look now as to who is the overseer, is it Itamar? Is it any such person? The overseer was really the one who was contracted was Hiram, the king of Tzur. That's not the same as Itamar. And who were the ones that were actually involved in the physical work? His people, Tsurim, people from Tsur. That's not Bezalel and the Chachmei Lev, which means that we already have, in a sense, if we can, through these markers, see a, something of a step down from the Mishkan to the first Beis HaMikdash. And this, says the Sforno, expresses itself in two ways. Number one, at a certain point, the Mishkan, it did fall into disrepair. It was neglected somewhat. We find in Melachim Beis, there was a whole launch, Beder Kabayis, to restore it to its glory. It didn't maintain its luster throughout. And of course, in the end, it fell into enemies' hands, and it was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. It didn't have the, in a sense, all of the milus of the Mishkan, ironically. And from there, we move to the second Beis HaMikdash. And with the second Beis HaMikdash, says the Sforno, again, consider all of these four points of those involved. Number one, or that which was involved. There was no Aron in the second Beis HaMikdash. And indeed, the Gemara in the end of the first parak of Maseches Yuma goes so far as to say that the Shekhinah was missing. The divine presence was missing from the Beis HaMikdash in the second Beis HaMikdash. Now, of course, we appreciate everything is relative. We say the Shekhinah is still there, even after the second Beis HaMikdash. And depending on where you look, you can see the Shekhinah could be in many places. The Mishnah tells us in Pirkei Avos that when 10 people get together, the Shekhinah is there. And if even one person is learning Torah, the Shekhinah is there. So clearly everything is relative and it's about context. But nonetheless, for what it is, and clearly in comparison and contrast to the first Beis HaMikdash, the Gemara states that the Shekhinah was missing. And the reason why is, number one, the Aron wasn't there, as we said. Number two, who's the initiator? Who's the Yozem V'boneh for the second Beis HaMikdash? It's Koresh. And he's the one that nothing's kind of really happening. Koresh gets everything going. We needed his sanction. And therefore, he is the presence, the overseeing presence. Well, Koresh is not a great miyuchas as far as we're concerned. What about Bnei Levi? Are they involved in the construction of the second Beis HaMikdash as they were in the Mishkan? Well, sadly, Ezra informs us that none of the Levim came back. There were Kohanim, Ezra himself was a Kohen, there were Kohanim, but there was no Levim. I don't know what they did for Sheni, but it went from Kohen to Yisrael. There's no Levim, and there were penalties levied, against the Levim. For not coming back, they were penalized. They couldn't receive maestros when they finally did come back. The Kohen would keep the maestros. He's also a Levi, a Kohen and a Levi. And those that were involved, once again, as the Psukim and Ksuvim and Ezra and Nehemiah described, they were Kutiyim and Sidonim and Suriyim and so on. Suriyim and Sidonim. And so once again, we see that it fell to the enemy, and this is the analysis of the Sforno. So it's quite fascinating because these details now, they're not just informative, they're evaluational. The Mishkan, first Beis HaMikdash, second Beis HaMikdash. And it's very interesting to note that the Sforno sees the destiny of the Mishkan or the Mikdash as a function of all of these things, not only what's in it in the end, who is behind it. Who is involved in it? It makes a difference. And this is true, interesting to note as parenthetically, but it's quite fascinating, that this is true for any endeavor of Torah, of Kedusha. It's not just about what's there in the end. How did it get there? And with what intention and with what motivation, with what idealism? The Gemara in the 12th parak of Maseches Ksubas, in Daf Kuf Gimel Amud Beis, describes a fascinating account from one of the sages of the Gemara, Rabbi Chiya. He describes how he saw to it that Torah was not forgotten in many areas of Eretz Yisrael. He took it upon himself to educate and the way that he did it, and it's described in great detail. He would sow flax, and then he would get it together, he would pick it and get it together, make nets with the flax. Now that's not help educating anyone yet. But he would use that to trap animals, those nets. And then he took the animals and he would shech them. And the flesh of the animal he gave to the needy. And with the hides of the animal he wrote Sifrei Torah. And when he finished writing a Sefer Torah, five chumashim, he would go to a village and where people did perhaps not know too much. And he did an amazing thing. He got the youngsters together, and he didn't just, quote-unquote, teach them. He didn't just teach them the Chumash and the Mishnah. He took each one aside and taught him a portion. He took each child and took him a Chumash, just one. And he took another child and taught him the other Chumash. And when he finished with the Chumashim, he taught a sixth child, one of the Siddurim of Mishnah. And then he said, between all of you, you know the five Chumashim, and you know Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. Now teach each other. He set each child up as a teacher for his peers, which is stunning. And then by the time he'd finished, and they'd finished learning from each other and teaching each other, they all knew everything. And that, says Rabbi Chiya, that's what I did. Asisi shilo tishtakach Torah miYisrael. The Torah should not be forgotten. So aside from the pedagogic element to teach not only students, but to teach young teachers in that way. But Meforshim ask, there seems to be a very elaborate process of preparation. I mean, at the end of the day, what you want is, you need a chumash, that's what you need. You could buy one, or contract someone to write them. So far back, he sows the flax, and makes the nets, and traps the animals, and then that's three or four stages that seemingly are unnecessary. And the Marsha comments on this. And Marsha says that in order for this venture to be a success, every stage needed to be done l'shem shamayim. Every stage needs to be done l'shem chinuch. If you buy the finished product and go out to teach, so then the roots of the enterprise, who knows where they came from. And therefore, Rabbi Chiya took upon himself the very klaf upon which the Sifrei Torah, he wrote them. And he prepared the whole thing for the sake of this. And the results were telling, because all of that preparation was decisive in terms of how successful the venture would be. I must say, parenthetically, we may be in the parentheses already, but I saw recently Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer from Berlin also comments, and everyone has the same question. I mean, that's a lot of time. It's a lot of time you could be teaching, that you're out trapping and shechting and sowing and putting the nets together. Why does Rabbi Chiya get involved in that? And Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer says an important chinuch vort, and that is that the extent to which a student will learn from a teacher is not just how bright the student is, how bright the teacher is, how talented the teacher is, and how much he knows. It's a function significantly of how much the student thinks the teacher cares about him. If he knows that the teacher put himself out for him, and we would be prepared to do something for him, so then the channel is open, and he's ready to receive. That's the person that he's prepared to learn from. And therefore, here are these Tamidim. And he didn't just show up with a Chumash and I'm ready to teach. These are Chumashim that he wrote with his own hands, for them. And he trapped the animals himself for them, and he gave them the meat, etc. So they begin by knowing how much he has invested in them, and how much the lengths he's gone in order to be ready to teach them. Those students are ready to learn. So that's a very important insight from Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. So, the point of resonance here is that all the preparatory stages had to be done right in order for the finished product to come out as desired. The final comment of the Sephorno here, in the beginning of the Parsha, relates to Pasuk Kaf Dalet. And again, not to lose sight of the Parshanut. Pasuk Kaf Dalet gives us really the tally or in terms of weight of the gold, kol hazahav ha'asulam lachabim leches hakodesh, all the gold was teisha ve'esrim kikar, 29 kikar, shvameos shloshim shekel b'shekel hakodesh, 730 shekel hakodesh. That's the amount. What is the meaning of this pasuk? So again, we should remember that understanding of this pasuk depends on how you understand the opening words Eile Pekude. According to Rashi, Eile Pekude means these are the amounts, which means they're actually really introducing pasuk Kaf Dalet. When it goes on to tell us the amounts, those are Pekude. The first two psukim were in a sense getting us back into things, mentioning certain things, but Eile Pekude is the amounts of the materials beginning with the gold. That's for Rashi. So that introduction is realized in Pasuk Kaf Dalet. Whereas, according to the Sforna, Pekude is about the distinction, and what then is the point of this Pasuk telling us how much gold there was. That's not about Pekude. And in the Sforna's words, he doesn't write at great length. But here he notes, Heid al kitzvas hazahav va'akesev anachoshes, the pasuk tells us about the amounts of gold, silver, copper that were involved in this mishkan. The point that the pasuk wants to bring across is that here's the amount of gold. It's not that much. That's the point. Again, comparing to. If you look in Sefer Melachim Aleph, and you'll see how much gold there was, enormous amounts. And no one outdid Herod in his renovations of the second Beis HaMikdash. I mean, that's where the gold was. So this is a modest amount of gold and silver. Yes. And yet, v'im kol zeh. And with all that, yoser hismid, marakvod Hashem b'mishkan shel Moshe, but the Shechina was more closely associated with the Mishkan of Moshe, mimasha hismid b'mikdash rishon, than it was in the first base of Mikdash, and certainly v'lo nira klal b'mikdash sheni, and certainly not in the second base of Mikdash. So there's a lesson here. The Torah speaks a lot about all these materials, but at the end of the day, it's not about those materials. Uvazeh hora, with this it teaches us, shelo kitzvas ha'osher, it's not the amount of riches, but godel habinyon, or the size of the building, yusib al-hashrish shechina b'Yisrael. They are not the causes for the shechina to dwell in Israel. Avarot Hashem es yireyav, u'maseyem l'shachna b'socham. It's the l'shem shamayim, it's the madreg of the people, it's how much purity of intent went into the building of the Mikdash. And that's, in a sense, a very interesting concluding thought. Whereas even physically, the Mishkan was less imposing and involved much lesser amounts, nonetheless, we do note that that's where the Shekhinah was more potently than in the others, also important. The Torah here is teaching us that these materials, they are meant to be a reflection and to support and enhance the level of the place, never to substitute for it or to replace it, because gold alone will not bring the Shekhinah down. So these are opening words to the Parsha, and from there I'd like to move towards the end, where actually the Pasuk describes the setting up of the Mishkan. According to Rashi, these are the Shivas Yemei HaMiluim, the seven preparatory days in Perek Mem. They are the last days of Chodesh Adar. And I'd like to take a look at Pasuk Yud Ches. So Pasuk Yud Zayin, of course, we'll begin just one Pasuk back. Vayhi b'chodesh harishon b'shana hashenis ah. And having described the Yemei HaMiluim, it then goes on to the actual first day of the Mishkan, what we will call Yom HaShmini in the first of time. B'chodesh harishon, on the first day of Nisan, b'shana hashenis b'echad l'chodesh, the first of the month, Rosh Chodesh Nisan, hukam ha-mishkan. And then the Pasuk describes, Vayaka Moshe ha-mishkan, Moshe set up the Mishkan. Vayitin es hadonov, vayasem es karashov, Vayiten es berichov, vayokem es amudov. Describes in detail all this is the body of the Mishkan. He set up the adonim, which are the sockets, the base, vayosem es kroshav, and then put the beams in them, and then he put the berichov, the poles through the beams, vayokem es amudov, also those pillars upon which the parochas were suspended, and the entrance to the Mishkan. Okay. Now, what's interesting about this pasuk is that we will see that it serves a halachic purpose for all time. There is a principle, which I believe we're familiar with, which states, Ma'alim ba'kodesh velo maridim. We go up in matters of Kedusha and not down. I think in our experience, the well-known example of that is on Hanukkah. I mean, that's what's behind the Shita of Beis Hillel, according to one opinion. The reason why we start with one candle and then go up is because Ma'alim ba'kodesh velo maridim. Now, there are two places in Chazal that identify the source of this principle. I mean, where does it come from? Ma'alim ba'kodesh, we all know it. Where is it from? There are two places in Chazal that identify the source of this principle in this pasuk Yuches. But what's interesting is that between these two sources, each one lays emphasis on a different part of that formula, because it's comprised of two parts. A, Ma'alim ba'kodesh, and B, Lo Maridin. Sometimes you can't be Malin anymore, but there's still Lo Maridin. According to that, speculatively, if a person, it's the fifth night of Hanukkah, and a person for the first four nights lit 1, 2, 3, 4, and then on the fifth night he only has four candles, should light four. You may say, well, what am I achieving? I'm not doing Ma'alim ba'kodesh. I mean, I don't have five. Ma'alim ba'kodesh he doesn't have, but he still has Ein Maridin. Still four, not to go down from yesterday. But that's those are Hanukkah matters. and both of these explanations will need to be understood. The Tosefta in Maseches Megillah comments on our pasuk and says, "Mikan shemalim ba'kodesh." We see from here malim ba'kodesh, and of course everyone wants to know, how do we see anything of the sort? I mean, you got Moshe setting up the Mishkan, but what's that got to do with Ma'alim ba'kodesh? Where does that come from? Rashi comments. Rashi says that the source of the idea of Ma'alim ba'kodesh is from the opening words of the pasuk, "Vayokem Moshe es ha-Mishkan." Moshe set up the Mishkan. What's that got to do with Ma'alim ba'kodesh? Says Rashi, consider. I mean, who has been involved in the Mishkan? Who made the Mishkan? It's Bezalel. Now, Bezalel is very great. Bezalel is very holy. But Moshe is greater, and Moshe is holier. And therefore, says Rashi, what the Tosefta means to do by citing our pasuk as the source for the idea of Ma'alim ba'kodesh is, look, Bezalel made it, but then Ma'alim ba'kodesh, when it came to set it up, it was Moshe that set it up. That's how Rashi explains how Ma'alim ba'kodesh comes from this pasuk. Moshe moving upwards from Bezalel. Okay. Interestingly, so one down, one to go. The Gemara elsewhere in Maseches Menachos and Daf Tzadik Tes quotes our pasuk and says, "Mikan." From here we see she'ein maridin, that we don't go down from kedusha. Now, where do we see ein maridin? Where in our pasuk is there that notion? Rabbeinu Bachya says a fascinating thing. The Mishkan, for though all of those days, was set up, although it's a discussion amongst the Mefarshim which days this applies to, and those details we're not going to get into, but for the beginning days, Moshe set up the Mishkan, but he also took it down every day. It's connected to the calculation as to when the Shivas Yimei HaMiluim were, but with Rabbeinu Bachya takes the approach that for those early days in Nisan, Moshe set up the Mishkan, but he also took it down. Every day was a new setting up. which is interesting because the pasuk here says that he set it up, but didn't say that he took it down. Now we may know from elsewhere that he took it down at the end of the day, but the pasuk doesn't say. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, that is the source of the Gemara. For Ein Meridin, one right, one goes up in Kedusha, one doesn't go down. And this interpretation of Rabbeinu Bachya is fascinating because the Malin and Meridin of the Mishkan isn't really the same as Malin and Meridin that we're talking about. We're saying one should always ascend in Kedusha, not to descend. And moreover, the reality is that Moshe did take it down. And that's okay. But in a sense, we're borrowing a motif. We're borrowing a theme. That even as the Torah describes it, it will explicitly refer to the setting up and will make no mention of taking down. And we then adapt that concept to how to appropriately choose between going up in Kedusha and not going down. So here we see that, as is often the case, Ma Talmud Lomar. Ma Talmud Lomar. What happened is the first question, and what does the Torah choose to say explicitly is the second question. And by omitting the reference to Meridin, that gives us then a halachic concept of Ein Meridin. Okay, so now we know. Now, I must say that as much as we've looked a lot on the opening words of the pasuk, Vayokem Moshe es HaMishkan, which could mean a number of things, again, to summarize, for Rashi, Vayokem Moshe, as opposed to Betzalel, that's Ma'alim Bakodesh, for Rabbeinu Bachya, Vayokem Moshe, and the pasuk doesn't say Vayorid Moshe, so that's for Loma Reading. But the pasuk also has other words in it, it keeps going, and it mentions four items that Moshe set up. Vayitin es Adonav, Vayosem es Karoshav, Vayitin es Brichav, Vayokem es Amudav. Those four items were set up by Moshe. Yet, they have different verbs for how it happened. In fact, you've got four items with three different verbs. The first is Vayitin es Adonav. But then it moves to Vayosem es Krashav, then back to Vayiten es Berichav, and then Vayokem es Amudav. That's interesting tsumet lev. I mean, what's between specifically Vayiten and Vayosem? Well, here we consult the Malbim, and the Malbim, of course, has plenty to say on this, as with all other similar sounding words. Whenever there's families of words, he will give us the character of each sibling. And the Malbim says, the difference between the word Vayitein and Vayosem, Netina versus Sima, is that Nesina, giving, as its name suggests, is the opposite of taking, and therefore it really just represents the general move towards putting something somewhere, if it's an object. Where specifically, or how specifically? Not of the essence. Sima, on the other hand, placing has a connotation of more care and precision and thought in terms of exactly what goes where. And thus we find, for example, just one or two examples from the Malbim's tour of Tanakh, when Yaakov, as he's running away, it says, Vayikach me'avni hamokom, vayosem mera'ashosav. He placed them around his head, and the Medrash comments on that he placed them in a very specific formation. And Rashi quotes it from the Medrash. Asotim kemarzev, he made it like a whole kind of pipe system around his head for protection, etc. Quite specific, quite carefully thought out, not just random or imprecise. And the reason why, says the Malbim, is because the pasuk says, Vayosem mera'ashosav. When you see the word vayosem, it means particularly, specifically. Similarly, says Malbim, in the beginning of Mishpatim, which has the word lasim in it, ve'elah mishpatim, asher tasim lifnehem, that you shall place before them. And again, Rashi comments from the Mechilta, how should Moshe place before them? Says Rashi, don't think quoting the Medrash, don't think to tell them the halacha and that's that. Rather, put it to them, explain it to them. Tell them what it's about. And where does that come from? And the pasuk just says, "Ashetasim lifnehem." But it says the Malbim, the Mechilta is noting the word tasim. Tasim means think about how you're going to say it, and think about how they'll retain it and understand it. So don't just tell them the halacha. Tell them the halacha. It's easy come, easy go. But if you explain to what's behind it, etc. and so forth, that's called Ashetasim lifnehem. Actually, the Torah Tumima elsewhere makes a similar observation and has a wonderful source that he quotes for when Avram sends Hagar away, the laning for first day of Rosh Hashanah and Parshas Vayera. So it says, Vayikach lechem bechemas mayim. So he took bread and water. Vayitena lagar. And gave it to Hagar. Sam al shichma. He placed it on her shoulder. So actually there, it's very interesting because you have these two words together. He did both. Vayitein al Hagar, sama shichma. But see the difference, says the Torah Tumima. When it says vayitein, it's very general. He just gave it to Hagar. How? Where? Doesn't say. But then it goes on to say, but exactly how? Some, where did he place it? Sama shichma. He put it on her shoulder. Sina is general. Sima is more specific. Okay. Now, what does this have to do with our pasuk? I mean, we're with the sockets and the beams, etc. There is a very interesting halacha with regards to the beams, the krushim of the Mishkan, right? The upright beams that formed the walls of the Mishkan. Namely, it was important always to retain the exact same order of those beams. Wherever a beam was in the first station, it needed to be as they set up the Mishkan again, elsewhere. Exact same formation. And in fact, this, interestingly, is the source in the Mishkan for the Malacha on Shabbos of writing. I mean, where did they write in the Mishkan? The Gemara says, they wrote on the beams. A, B, Aleph, Beis, to know exactly which beam was where, so that the order would be preserved. However, the Malbim states that this requirement is only with the beams themselves. There's no parallel requirement with the sockets underneath, those silver sockets, if it was underneath this one as opposed to that one earlier on. That's not of the essence. It's specifically with regards to the beams. Okay. Why is the Torah so insistent that wherever a beam was originally, it should stay there? Well, the answer is Ma'alim Bakodesh for Emaridim. What determined the placement of each beam was its proximity to the Aron. And that's where we learned halachas from there, that a beam that was closer to the Aron originally should not be, quote unquote, demoted and distanced from the Aron later on. There shouldn't be a reshuffle of the beams so that which was closer is then more distant. Interestingly, this is also the source for a hanhaga that many people have. Well, to a certain degree, everyone has it. It's a question of how much you make of it. Namely, to put an atara on a talis, to have the part that covers the head, it should be marked. Now, it could be marked with just something relatively simple, like a satif petitis or something, like some material. Others are a bit more elaborate. It could be silver, it could be whatever it may be. But where does it come from? It's based on this halacha, because the part of the talis, if you didn't have that, you could end up switching your talis upside down the next day, which means that the part that was closer to the head on day one is then closer to the feet on day two, and that's the equivalent of the beam that was closer to the Aron on day one being more distant. But that's Ein Meridin. We have to assume that the person's head is holier than his feet. Well, this being the case, I wonder whether one may suggest that perhaps this is where we see in the pasuk the idea of Ma'alim HaKodesh V'lo Meridin. In other words, if we come back to the pasuk which states vayitnes Adonav. The reason why it says vayiten is because with all the elements, all the items, that it doesn't really matter where it is, so it doesn't really matter where you place it. So that can be vayiten. Vayitnes Adonav. But vayosem is karoshav, but the beams, it does matter. So then the verb shifts to vayosem. Remember where you put this. Put it in exactly the same place next time. But then back again for the poles that go through, there's no such insistence. So it's back to vayiten es berichav. So the shift from vayiten to vayosem, where are we particular, where are we not particular? Okay, but if that's true, then essentially this pasuk has written through it, through its fabric, the idea that the beams, it makes a difference where it was. Don't put it somewhere else. But why not? Because ein meridin. Maybe that's another way that the Gemara sees within this pasuk the idea of ein meridin, the insistence of location for the beams. Okay. So having discussed Parshas Pekudei, we are in a very fortunate position because we are strategically placed between the Arba Parshios. Last week, Shkolim. Next Shabbos will be Zohar. And this week, it's just Pekudei, which means that we have a rare opportunity for us to take a look at the Haftorah of Parshas Pekudei. Sometimes it can go unread for a while. And the Haftorah for Pekudei is from Malachim Aleph, Perek Ches. It actually begins with the final pasuk of Perek Zayin, but it's predominantly taken from Perek Ches. And it's the Chanukah Sabayis of Shlomo HaMelech, clearly connected to the setting up of the Mishkan, once again paralleled to in later times. And at a certain point in the Haftarah, I'm not sure if you have the markings of the references of the Psukim, but a little bit towards the end, it's in Pasuk Yud Ches of Perek Ches. For, again, coming back in Pasuk Yud Zayin, Shlomo HaMelech describes how his father really wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash, which we know he did. Vayihi, in Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayihi im levav David avi, livnos bayis, it was very much in his heart to build this Beis HaMikdash, l'shem Hashem Elokei Yisrael. But it was not to be, as we know. Pasuk Yud Ches, Vayom Hashem al David avi. Yan asher haya im levavcha livnos bayis lishmi hetivosa ki haya im levavecha. You wanted to build a bayis, and that's good, but it won't happen. Rak ata lo tivne habayis ki im bincha yim heyotzei mechalasecha. Hu yivne habayis lishmi. It's not going to be you, it's going to be your son. And this we know. What caught my attention towards the beginning of Pasuk Yud Ches is the word ya'an. Because ya'an means because. But this really doesn't sound like because. It sounds like in spite of. Although. Right? Although you wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash, which is a good thing, but it's not going to be you. It can't be saying because you wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash, it's not going to be you. So how does the word ya'an, how does A lead to B? It sounds like B is in spite of A, not a result of A. Perhaps on a simple chat level, Hashem is telling David that it's not going to be you, but because you wanted it so much, at least it will be your son. At least it will be from your family, perhaps on a chat level. In Perek Tes, which is already beyond the Haftarah, but in Perek Tes, Pasuk Gimel, Hashem responds to Shlomo's declarations about the Beis HaMikdash and says, Hikdashti, Es Habayis Hazeh, Shlomo, at length, it's a long Perek Ches, he asks Hashem, he should always hear the tefillos of the Jewish people in all circumstances. It's almost 70 psukim is Perek Ches. And Hashem says, Shamati es tefilascha, es trinoscha asher es chananta lefanai. I've heard your plea in your prayer. Hikdashti Es Habayis Hazeh Asher Banisa. I have indeed sanctified this house, that you built Lasum Shem Yisham Ad Olam, that my name should be there forever. V'hayu Einai V'libi Sham Kol Hayomim. My eyes, my heart will be there all days. And what, that's a very specific expression. V'hayu Einai V'libi Sham Kol Hayomim. And we should be interested to find out perhaps some aspect of the connotation of that phrase. Well, Meshach Chochma explains, he has a couple of comments on the Haftorah of this week's parsha. What would we say about the Beis HaMikdash? It represents the center of the divine presence amongst Bnei Yisrael. We say the Shechina is there, L'shaken Shemo Sham. And Shechina for us, as the Noda Yehuda says, it's an abstract concept, obviously, but practically it will reflect itself in Hashem's supervision of the Jewish people. The Noda Yehuda says, Shechina is from the word Shachen. Shachen, a neighbor, to be in the proximity of something. And when you're a Shachen, or Shochein, you can better supervise. And therefore that's the Torah's way of communicating this idea that supervision is called the Shechina. As we know, broadly, there are really two types of supervision. There's two types of divine providence. There is Hashgacha Geluya, revealed, and Hashgacha Nisteris, concealed. And generally, at the time when there is a Beis HaMikdash, and therefore that center is there for the Shechina, so then the Hashgacha is more revealed, right? There are miracles that would take place regularly in the Beis HaMikdash. At a time of Galus, it's no longer a time of Hashgacha, Geluya, not open and revealed in that way. And yet, the correct way to say this, says Meshech Chachma, is because don't forget, the Shechina is always there. Pasuk says, the Shechina will be there forever. We say, Hineo made Acha Kasleinu, the Shechina lo zozo mikoso maravi. So what that means is that the difference between when the Beis HaMikdash is standing and not standing is not whether the Shechina is there, but whether it's revealed or concealed. That means that the Shechina is yet in the Beis HaMikdash, even during a time of Golus. It's in the Makom HaMikdash, but it's concealed, it's covered. There is a fascinating drasha on the Pasuk we say in the beginning of Hallel, Moshivi Akeres Habayis. That Hashem settles Akeres Habayis. Akeres Habayis has a very positive connotation. But the Gemara in Pesachim and Daf Kuf Yud Ches says Moshivei Akeres Habayis is when the Shechina settles very low into the Beis HaMikdash. So low that it's at the Ikar Habayis. It's like in the foundations, but it's no higher than that. It's there somewhere in on the foundational level. In the words of the Gemara, Samuni, the spirituality says, Samuni kechulda, be made like a chulda, like a weasel. Hadar b'ikari Abayas, who lives there in the lower recesses of the house. That's where the Shechina is. Akeres Habayas. But the Shechina is always there. And that's why, says Meshech Chochma, even if one cannot bring korbanos in the Makom HaMikdash in our times, and he is of the opinion that one cannot, because the Shechina is not revealed enough to have that relationship, that's his understanding. But wasn't it always true that if there wasn't really the Shechina in the Mikdash, then there could be bomos, there could be private altars? That was true very often. When there's no Mishkan, so then people could offer korban in their own yard. Boma. But there's no bomos anymore. But if you can't bring korbanos in the Makom HaMikdash, so why not bring in a boma? The answer, says Meshech Chochma, is because the Shechina has receded there in the Makom HaMikdash. It's not expressed in a way that one could bring korbanos there, but it hasn't disappeared, and therefore it yet precludes bringing a korban anywhere else. It's still there. We mentioned last week the concept of Hashem's tefillin, that very esoteric concept in the Gemara, Hashem wears tefillin. Mika amcha Yisrael, that's what it says in his tefillin. Mika amcha Yisrael, goyachad ba'aretz. The Meshech Chochma in Parshas Bo. And of course, it's a tefillin, kesher tefillin, it's about Hashem's connection with Bnei Yisrael. But we should be mindful that there are actually two tefillin. There are two types of tefillin. There's tefillin shel yad, tefillin shel rosh. And the difference, or one of the significant differences between them, is the tefillin revealed or concealed. And this actually distinguishes the shel yad from the shel rosh. The tefillin shel yad is typically covered over. Some even say should be covered over. It doesn't have to be. But the tefillin shayat, it says, v'haya lecha le'os, for you and os, not for others. It's very private in that way. And it's not so openly visible. Contrast that tefillin shal rosh, where the pasuk says, everyone will see it. V'ro'u kal amei ha'aretz, ki shem Hashem nikra alecha, v'yar'u mimecha. It's the opposite in that respect. And says the Meshech Chochma, if the idea of tefillin is meant to represent Hashem's connection, special connection with Bnei Yisrael, and we're mindful of the fact that there are two emanations of that connection, two expressions of that connection, revealed Hashgacha and concealed Hashgacha, so then, of course, we understand that that's why in Hashem's tefillin, so to speak, the tefillin shel yad is the concealed Hashgacha. The tefillin shel rosh is Hashgacha geluya. And with that in mind, says the Meshech Chochma, there in Parshas Shemos, in Parshas Shemos, Perek Gimel, so we go back to the Pasuk in Perek Tes, Pasuk Gimel, Hashem says, exactly in this Pasuk is a summation of everything. Hikdashti es habayis, Hashem says to Shlomo, I've sanctified the house, habayis hazeh, hashebonisa, losum shemisham at the olam, my name will be there always. Yes. Always, in one form or another. Not always revealed. Sometimes concealed. Sometimes akeres habayis, beikuri habayis. And then it says, v'hayu einai velibi sham kol hayomim. Kol hayomim, all days, my eyes and my heart will be there. And now we get a deeper understanding of what it means that Hashem says his eyes and his heart will be there. Because the eyes and the heart correspond to the two types of tefillin. The tefillin shel rosh, right, bein einecha, and the tefillin shel yad al levavcha. And the idea of kol hayomim, although Hashem says that his name will always be there, but there's a concept called yomim. Yomim is day when things are revealed and clear, meaning during the time of when the Mikdash is standing, kol hayomim, so then Hashem's eyes and heart will be there. That means Hashgacha will be revealed, not only Shayad, but also Shal Rosh. In contrast to days which are not called Yomim, which really are more like night, a time of Golus, so then the eyes and heart won't be there. The heart will always be there. That's the Tefillin Shal Yad, because the Shekhinah will always be concealed, like the Shayad is concealed. The eyes, not always. And what does this have to do with our Haftorah? Says Meshech Chochma back to the Haftorah of Parshas Pekudei. He really is unique here. The Pasuk says in Eicha that when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, it describes the gates of the Beis HaMikdash as sinking into the ground. Tov u'ba'aret sha'areha. That's the Pasuk Tes of the first parak of Eicha. The gates sunk into the ground. Why did the gates sink into the ground? I mean, what's the significance of that? Says Meshechach, says the Gemara in Maseches Sota and Daf Tes, those gates were made by David HaMelech. Interesting. Of all the Beis HaMikdash in general was not made by David, but he made the gates. Practically he had some contribution. And the Gemara says the level of David HaMelech was as such that no one could undo what he had done. If he made the gates, they could not be destroyed. If the Beis HaMikdash is being destroyed, the gates receded. They sunk into the ground, but they can never be destroyed. Because ma'asov lo kolim, his actions endure. Everything else was made by others, and they could be destroyed. The actions of David cannot be destroyed. The contribution of David cannot be undone. Says Meshech Chochma, we need to appreciate that the contribution of David HaMelech to the Beis HaMikdash was not just, quote-unquote, the gates. There was another contribution. What else did he contribute? His will. He wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash. His desire to build the Beis HaMikdash. It never found expression. But the will of David HaMelech doesn't go away. His desire to build the Beis HaMikdash was concealed within him and never expressed outside of him. Says Meshech Chochma, that's also a contribution to the Mikdash because it allowed for something in the Mikdash also to remain inside of it, even if it's not expressed, namely the Shekhinah. David HaMelech was the catalyst for the permanence of the Shekhinah in the Beis HaMikdash. And that's why, coming back to our Pasuk now, the gates he made practically, the Shekhinah he made through his intention, allow that to come to rest in the Mikdash. And Pasuk Yud Ches reads again, Vayomar Hashem al David Avi Ya'an, Asher hayom levavcha livnos bayis lishmi hetivosa ki hayom levavcha. Hetivosa, says the Meshech Chochma, we would understand that hetivosa means that you did a good thing. Good. Good for you, but not good enough, apparently. Hetivosa. But Meshe Chochma notes, hetivosa is a causative. Hetivosa. You actually bestowed good. You have done a good thing. You brought about a good thing. What did he bring about? Says Meshe Chochma, because that will of David to build the Mikdash also found its mark. It also became a contribution, and that was a great contribution to the Mikdash, because then the Shekhinah will always be there. And with that in mind, he doesn't mention the word Ya'an, but of course we go back to the word Ya'an, and 100% it is a result of Asher Levavcha. So therefore there is a product of David's will. It's not just, although you wanted to, you're not able to, because you wanted to. That's a unique contribution, because what David contributes doesn't go away. And he was, again, a pipeline, a conduit for contributing the presence of the Shekhinah there, and that doesn't go away. It's still there, waiting to be brought back to the surface, waiting that not only should it be concealed in that way, not only should it be Libi, but the full Einai V'Libi Sham Kol HaYomim, and that should be V'Meher V'Yamin.